funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are very happy to begin our week of shows from NPR headquarters, the source of news programming for more than 26 million listeners every week. That programming is largely coordinated out of this office, but it's reported from 34 foreign and domestic news bureaus. The idea is to put journalists, and therefore audiences, as close to world events as possible, and to deliver stories across platforms that now include blogs, mobile apps, video, interactive digital, podcasts, and, of course, on-air broadcasts. New technologies provide a wonderful array of tools for conveying information, and they also present a widening array of decisions to be made about how to best serve NPR audiences. We've invited Chris Turpin here to talk about that. He is Vice President of News Programming for NPR. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me, and welcome to Washington for the week.
It's lovely to be here. Beautiful studios. So the big story this morning is the dire situation in Nepal after the 7.8 magnitude earthquake that hit Saturday. Tell us a little bit about how you mobilize staff to respond to unexpected breaking news stories.
Well, this is where we're lucky that we have 17 foreign bureaus, because we're in a very good position to mobilize for these kind of things. In this case, you know, once we learned of the earthquake, you immediately start thinking about who you can get into Kathmandu, who is the appropriate people to be there. Obviously, Julie McCarthy is our New Delhi bureau chief, and so she was top of the list and the obvious person to get there. And then there are these strange kind of sort of serendipities that always seem to happen when news happens, where we seem to accidentally have people in the right place. We happen to have Kirk Siegler, who's actually a domestic reporter from LA, who was in Hong Kong on his way to Kathmandu to do a fellowship. And so he is going there and now doing a different kind of reporting for us. And then we have a core of producers who have experience in these circumstances. And we send Russell Lewis, who's one of our producers, very, very good producer, has gone out there. He's got a lot of experience. He was most recently in the Philippines when we had the disaster there a year or so ago. So we're sort of well equipped. And we have, you know, there's always a news manager here. So Saturday morning, there was the right people here. We have a pretty good systems in place at this point in time for knowing what we need to do.
Let's listen to a little bit of Julie McCarthy's conversation this morning with Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition.
When you reach Bhaktapur, the first thing we encountered was anger. Angry residents lining up outside the headquarters of the district police. 400,000 people were affected in that district, and the deputy superintendent of police said 4,000 homes had been damaged to the point of being uninhabitable.
What does it look like when you go into those areas where there's so many thousands of homes uninhabitable?
Well, what you see is, because it's strewn across the Kathmandu Valley, so you see pocks of houses against this beautiful landscape that have rumbled to the ground. And a lot of these areas, Steve, are narrow warrens of these ancient homes built with wood that are fragile structures and, of course, therefore very vulnerable to earthquakes. And the big debate now that's coming up here is why there hasn't been more done to really safeguard this precious heritage.
How are the crews that are in Nepal right now dealing with mobility issues, given the remoteness of some of the worst affected areas?
I think, you know, have the same problems that everyone does, which is how you get out to these areas. And when you get to these places, you have to find fixers. You have to find people who you can obviously rent equipment from, cars, so on and so forth, so you can get out to these areas. And I think, you know, part of what we're seeing right now is that there are still large parts of the country that people have really not got to. Lots of villages where no relief has reached yet, no journalists have reached yet, and journalists are now starting to get to.
Another thing we heard this morning was a woman on Facebook who was basically telling her friends and family the situation that she was observing. As more and more people are reporting their own lives on social media, what does it take to verify those accounts and make sure that they're worthy of broadcast?
That's a really good point. I mean, I think one of the things that's changed drastically, as you point out, over the last few years is social media. People can immediately start covering these events. They're claiming to be there. They're claiming to see things. And we have to be very, very careful in making sure that we actually are able to verify using the same techniques that we use to verify all kinds of things, you know, that we do in our daily reporting lives, that the people really are who they say they are, they really are where they say they are, and they really have seen what they say they saw. So, and at the end of it, there's also a level of gut check in that. You have to have a certain sense that this just feels right. And, you know, and I think we've touched wood so far, we've been very good at that.
So with 17 foreign bureaus, 17 domestic bureaus, how does everybody stay in contact on a typical news day, if there is such a thing?
Well, that is a very good question. We have a sort of central news hub. We have two deputy managing editors, and their job is basically to sort of run the daily coverage and coordinate the daily coverage. Every reporter has an editor who they report to. And in this day and age, there's obviously a million different ways of staying in contact with people. It's actually a lot easier than it used to be. I've been, you know, always hearing these stories from the past about, you know, people going off and covering campaigns 30, 25, 30 years ago and using the first cell phones and having to go out and rent bizarre equipment in order to get their story back. Of course, now we can get stories back instantly through tweeting. We can communicate with editors through texting. It's in some ways the act of journalism has become a lot easier than perhaps it was for some of our forebearers.
Have you experimented at all with this new Periscope technology that allows people to actually broadcast video live?
We have done a little bit. Elise Hugh, who's in our Seoul bureau, has been doing a little bit of that. She was down at the DMZ recently while Yarmo, our CEO, was actually visiting, and she did some live periscoping from the DMZ between the two Koreas. So, you know, we obviously, like everyone, are trying to explore all the different platforms, all the different technologies out there, and then trying to decide which of those we should, you know, really invest in, which of those actually help us reach audiences, new audiences, and which of those genuinely sort of serve our audiences by allowing us to do something of value for them.
How are correspondents, particular correspondents, assigned to foreign bureaus, and what do they do if they don't have a great deal of knowledge of that culture, that society, the politics locally before they arrive?
There's obviously a lot of sort of speed learning. I mean, language is an important part of it. So, you know, very often we'll send someone to language school if they don't necessarily have the language skills. When David Green went to Russia, for example, he went out there a little while ahead of time. He started Russian classes, intensive Russian classes. Obviously, it's helpful to have a grasp of language. We also, you know, people put themselves through an education, basically, to learn. And obviously, in many cases, you're hiring people who have some background in the region, who have some knowledge and come with at least some initial tools. But I mean, one of the interesting things about foreign reporting is sometimes the best reporting comes from those people who have the freshest eyes and the freshest perspectives, because the things that they see, not having had much experience of the place or the culture, are often the things that are really interesting and engaging and tell you about the country in a way that perhaps people who've been there longer or people who are more versed in the country don't actually quite recognize anymore.
Is there an ideal duration for a foreign bureau posting?
I don't know. I think if you asked foreign editor Edith Chapin, she might have some ideas on that. I think it varies. I mean, we've had people, look, Silvia Pagioli has been in Rome for, you know, decades at this point in time. Other people we've moved around fairly frequently. I'm not sure there is an ideal length. I think a lot of it depends on the individual. It depends on their life. It depends on their curiosity. It depends on their unique set of skills that they bring to their reporting.
How do you budget for events that you can't predict ahead of time that might take a great deal of resources?
That's a really interesting question. You know, we know that we're always going to face several big news stories over the course of the year, and we have to work out how we're going to be able to pay for them. And we just always know that, you know, budgeting in our business has to be very fungible. We have to be able to work out, to spend money on this, we're going to have to cut back on spending money on this. You know, we're going to have to move pots of money around. This year, obviously, we made a huge commitment to the Ebola story, which, you know, blew up any budget that we originally had for the particular desks and parts of the desk that were focused on covering that story. But, you know, we made it happen by deciding that it was a priority and that we were really going to, you know, we weren't going to let money be an obstacle to telling the story that we felt needed to be told.
Did that coverage play out in a different way than it would have even a decade ago in terms of the resources that you allocated and the way you actually put people on site?
Yeah, I mean, all our coverage does. I mean, we obviously, we live in a multi-platform universe now. I mean, that's the most obvious part of this. I mean, we just won a Peabody, not to blow our own trumpet, but we just won a Peabody Award for our Ebola coverage. And we were actually writing a list, kind of compiling a list. Dan Gudenkoff, our head of our science desk, compiled a list of all the people who played a significant role in that coverage. It was over 90 people. And obviously not all of those people were on the front lines of the coverage in Liberia and in Guinea, but they were the people who really, really reported the story on blogs from here, really helped us get the social media word out, who really, you know, helped in all kinds of other ways. So, you know, we're a multimedia organization at this point. We try to reach our audience wherever they are, and that means being present on all kinds of different platforms. And that's probably the biggest single difference.
One of the things the Peabody Committee said was that it appreciated that some of the Ebola reporting actually focused on positive stories. So let's listen here to a bit of Nurit Eisenman's report on a hospital in Sierra Leone that took a calculated risk giving IVs to patients.
Still, the staff at Hastings resolved to give IVs a try. They had their most experienced nurses insert them. To date, none of the workers have gotten infected. As for the patients, it's difficult to pinpoint survival statistics for any one center when the sample size is small and the outbreak is still unfolding. But based on the data so far, Sase says Hastings' death rate is way down.
Out of every 10 patients, 4 will die and 6 will come out. So 60% are cured and 40% will die.
Sase also noticed another effect. The workers at the center, the nurses, the support staff, once they realized the patients had a fighting chance,
everybody became very, very enthusiastic, and we started talking to the patients. We even started giving bed baths. We started feeding our patients. So it was really, really, we became so motivated, and things changed drastically.
What does it take, Chris Turpin, to find some positive stories in the midst of so much fear and chaos? Does it really just require a different way of relating to the people who are affected by these stories?
I think the positive stories are always there. And, you know, having myself covered an earthquake back in 2008 as part of the ATC, the All Things Considered crew who were in Chengdu in China, the extraordinary thing is that the worst of times often bring out the best of times in people. And, you know, there are always remarkable and miraculous stories. And I think one of the things about the whole Ebola story was that we tried to do, and I think all of our reporters did absolutely brilliantly, was to bring real perspective to this, that not to get into the sort of panicky kind of this is a global plague story coverage that unfortunately there some quarters there was, but to try to really present a very nuanced vision of what was happening in these countries. And that means there are stories of survival. There are stories of things getting better, not just getting worse. And I think Nurit and Jason Bovien or Fabia Quistart and the other reporters who were there just did an incredible job of capturing that.
And what sort of communication is there on the ground when you have a team of people who don't normally work side by side trying to get all aspects of a breaking story?
Well, again, I think, you know, we're very lucky in this day and age that communications have become a lot easier. I mean, all of these folks have satellite phones, obviously. They're able to talk to each other over the internet, where often, even where you would think it unlikely now, internet connections can be surprisingly good. So there was an ability to have a lot of communication, a lot of coordination. There was a lot of talking between the correspondents about what they were finding, sharing of information, a huge amount of off-air reporting, which never gets to the air, but is absolutely critical in really developing a deep understanding of the story.
We're speaking this hour with Chris Turpin, who is NPR's Vice President for News Programming. We're talking about the inner workings of journalism at NPR as we continue Think in D.C. Week, or we begin Think in D.C. Week. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. This week, you can follow the hashtag ThinkInDC and get a look at the behind-the-scenes action on our new Tumblr. It's at kerathink.tumblr.com. My guest for this hour is Vice President for News Programming at NPR, Chris Turpin. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org. Or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Chris, with regard to the Ebola story, it would be wrong to talk about serendipitous timing given how tragic the consequences of that were. But NPR had just launched this globally focused blog, Goats and Soda, and I want to talk about that. Before we do, for people who aren't familiar, can you explain this crazy name and the focus of the blog and what it's for?
I'm not sure I can explain the crazy name other than a huge amount of thought went into deciding what the name is. It sort of encapsulates the range of things that development folks think about. In the idea of these of our global health vertical, as we call it, which is really a sort of buzzword for a multi-platform desk, was really to focus on global health and development stories, but to do it in a way that's really accessible, lively, fun, engaging, that can both appeal to an audience of experts and people deeply engaged in the topic, but can also hopefully draw general interest listeners, readers into wanting to follow these kinds of issues. And I will say it's been fantastically successful. I mean, it's amazing that obviously the timing was serendipitous but the blog was a huge resource during the Ebola crisis and got a lot of heavy traffic. A lot of people came to rely on it. And the team that put it together did some pretty amazing reporting that really sort of supplemented and complemented the reporting that our folks are, actually out there in Liberia, Guinea, and so on were doing.
There was a time when reporters in all media would file whatever stories they had for the day at a particular time and then be done until the following day. Now we have not just 24-hour deadlines, but really the expectation that things will continue to be updated. How has that changed the way your teams work?
It's probably made their lives a lot harder in many ways. You're kind of never off the clock now, and that I think is one of the difficult things of being a journalist day in, day out, because not only is it about your own stories and what's happening with your own stories and that you have to keep updating them, you have to keep thinking about, is it time producing the web component to them, the social media component and all these other things, but then there's also other people's stories are happening in that time, and then that creates the need for you very often to, can we verify that a certain story another organization is reporting is true? So then that reporter has then to spend some time doing that and calling their sources and trying to work out whether we feel comfortable reporting something that, say, the New York Times is reporting. So I think this is one of the, it's both new technology has been very exciting. The multi-platform world is very exciting. And I think on the whole, most people would say they really enjoy it. They really enjoy trying their hand at telling stories in different ways. They love the immediacy of it. You have someone like David Falkenflik, our media reporter, who's actually reported stories almost in real time on Twitter in a way that is very distinctive and engaging. At the same time, I think people would tell you that it means that, you are never off the clock anymore. There's no such thing as really as a news cycle. We still talk about a news cycle, but at this point, it's a constant cycle.
No news organization can cover every worthy story. So how does NPR make decisions about what not to focus on?
Well, that's a very interesting and good question. I mean, I think that, we're looking for stories where we can be original, where we can be compelling, where we can be engaging, and where we can really bring added value to them. We try to stay away from sort of moment by moment incrementalism if we can, because, there's a place for that at NPR. You hear those kind of stories on the newscast. But when you come to our news magazine programs, for example, we try to do stories that we hope are explanatory, that have a that really focus on the why of why something is happening. We want to make sure that listeners, readers, you know, however people are consuming this, that we really are providing added value, that we're providing context, we're helping them understand why something is important and significant and worthy of their time.
What's the relationship between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and how are decisions made about the way a particular story will be handled on each program?
Well, we don't talk. They don't talk to each other. They just fight all the time. We throw things.
I was going to ask you about healthy tension between the two.
I think there's not even really tension anymore. I think one interesting thing is we moved to this new building a couple of years ago, and we're now right on the same floor. We're really those two shows are right next door to each other, and actually it's interesting. Geography really is destiny. It's changed the way the shows relate to each other. In our old building, they were literally were on other sides of the building, and there was less contact. And one of the things we've tried to do is we want ATC and Morning to be distinct and different and original, and to be thinking about their own stories and how they want to tell them. But we also want to have a degree of centralization. So we have like a centralized news desk, because we want to make sure that over the course of the day, we're really driving stories forward. There's a real arc to our coverage across the day, and that we're really moving stories forward in a way that doesn't feel over repetitive for listeners, that really feels like we're pushing and thinking about the most interesting angles, and that we're constantly thinking of that in the context of all of the different platforms we're on. So I would say, you know, once in a while a fight breaks out over something, but most of the time there's more than enough news to go round. And this is a very collaborative environment. I mean, NPR is a very collaborative place, and it's one of the pleasures of working here is for the most part, you couldn't work with a nicer group of people.
How much do you have to think, Chris, about time-shifted listening? The fact that a story may be crafted to go specifically into a particular newscast, but people might come to it hours later, and really without that context that you've built within a program.
Yes. Well, I mean, increasingly, we have to think about serving two different audiences. And I mean, right now, much of our content is still essentially generated for our main news magazine shows that go out at, you know, a particular time of day. And then, yeah, you're right. A lot of people will hear them later. Well, they'll hear them on demand, essentially. So, you know, like everyone, we're trying to juggle how you make sure that you serve the on-demand audience. In NPR One, sometimes we'll not put up stories that clearly are going to date very, very quickly and that will be out of date by the time people hear them. To some degree, we're also reliant on people knowing they're listening on demand and understanding that they're not listening in real time. And, you know, one of the questions that we grapple with is how much content do we need to start producing for those other on-demand platforms that's very specific to them and isn't necessarily content that would be on stories that would be on the news magazine shows. So I don't really have a perfect answer for that, because I think, like everyone, we're still grappling with the notion that you can't take time out of news reporting, and yet people are consuming information often days after it was originally produced, the time period it was originally produced for.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. We have a tweet here from Michael who says, "We hear a lot about newsroom cuts at other outlets. How is this trending for NPR News?"
We went through a difficult period before the beginning of this financial year, which is September. We had to make some. We had a buyout, like many organizations have had, and sadly we lost a lot of very talented people, and we're having to live within our means a little bit. But generally, we have done very well compared to most organizations. That's really thanks to our listeners and the fact that our audience has been very robust. Thanks to our stations who've been doing very well and who help us pay the bills here. So, you know, in many ways, we're in a very, very good position. We have done very well. We haven't endured the kind of things that have happened to newspapers or in television. But we're also very aware that we're in an incredibly competitive environment. And this is a really interesting moment for any news organization.
What have you learned about the right way to do coverage or the way that your audience expects you to cover things, given the fact that it is so very easy for people to respond instantly to something they have heard or read and either like or dislike?
I don't think the instantness of the response actually changes the values that people expect from the coverage. I mean, I think people expect public radio to be generally serious. That doesn't mean that we don't like to laugh or do funny stories, but they want us to be thoughtful. They want us to be respectful. They want us to go deeply with stories and issues and not be superficial. And I think that that's something that has not changed with the advent of new technologies. It was there from our first listeners in the 1970s to our current generation of listeners now.
Is it possible to identify a typical NPR audience member? I mean, can you make generalizations?
Well, it depends which, it depends where they are experiencing us. If you're listening to a broadcast news magazine, that listener is in their 50s. They're tending to trend a little older than they used to. If you're listening to us on NPR One, the NPR news app, which is a sort of Pandora-like experience for listening to NPR, you're getting a much younger audience. So it a little bit depends on where you're looking for that audience. But on the broadcast news magazines, it's trending a little older as the years go by.
What do you see as the future for terrestrial radio, given that younger people are much more apt to use a mobile device to download content or to stream content?
Well, I think quite a lot of older people are pretty adept at using those devices as well, which is sort of what's interesting. I think terrestrial radio is very robust. We still have an enormous broadcast radio audience. Americans still use broadcast radio a lot. I think terrestrial radio still has a very rich future. Yar Mohn, our CEO, has a phrase where he always refers to terrestrial radio as the cockroach of broadcasting, which I'm not sure I like that image, but there is something about that image. The death of radio has been predicted many times, and I think we're a long, long way from that. That said, we can't dispute the fact that people are increasingly turning to listening on other devices. I mean, I listen probably on like four or five, come to my NPR content in four or five different ways now, between our NPR One app, the NPR app, the public radio app, NPR on iTunes. There are all these different ways of accessing NPR. So, we also have to make sure that we're growing our audience in other places, paying attention to the millennial audience, paying attention to sort of other demographics who are hopefully going to be the core of our listenership in a few years' time.
Talk about the relationship between NPR News here in Washington and local stations that might provide content depending on the story and what's happened.
Well, stations are obviously, we couldn't do what we do without stations. I mean, it's the member stations are absolutely an integral part of what NPR does. And we're actually involved in trying to deepen that collaboration. One of the things that is obvious is that in many localities, local newspapers have dropped away. And that's offered public radio a huge opportunity and local stations a huge opportunity to do a real public service and provide the kind of coverage that newspapers used to provide in their communities. And so what you've seen in recent years is local stations' newsrooms have grown, have become stronger, have become more vibrant. We just did a survey last year. There's about 1,400 public radio journalists out there around the country, at least according to our survey. And that's a huge potential resource at the national level. And one of the things we're working really hard on is what we're calling the Collaborative Coverage Project, which is really worth trying to find ways that we can leverage that relationship better for a national audience, how we can work with local stations to get more local reporting that matters on the air nationally, and how we can also help those newsrooms with skills that we have in terms of, our ability to access sources in Washington, our ability to do big number crunching, data crunching, type things that we have an expertise in, that we can help local newsrooms at our member stations do more incisive reporting that really serves their community well.
So the idea is to have everybody sort of trained up for the moment when something of national import happens in one of these local areas.
Well, the truth is there are things of national import are happening in those areas all the time. I mean, for example, a great many stations have education correspondents, and education is a perpetual national issue. So our education desk has been working with a group of stations and station reporters, really trying to make sure that, education coverage is covered by a broad swath of reporters from around the country. So it really is. It becomes like we're trying to basically give a larger role to member station reporting in our daily news product, if you want to put it that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Merrill in Fort Worth. Hi, Merrill.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question about how NPR compensates its reporters. Are they, all of these reporters all over the world and in the United States, are they full-time salaried employees? Do they work exclusively for NPR? And what about the ones who we only hear infrequently, say Silvia Poggioli in Italy? Does she work, is she a freelancer? Is she paid by the story that gets reported and broadcast? Does she work for maybe some other Italian news agency?
Thanks for your question, Merrill. We'll get an answer for you.
Yeah, there's really, we have a lot of reporters who are obviously full-time reporters, among them Silvia Poggioli, and who are paid, you know, a salary and all the kind of benefits that you'd expect. We then have some people who are on contract. They work for us for a certain amount of time per week or per month. And they get essentially they're paid as part-time, as if you want to put it that way. And then we use freelancers, particularly, around the globe. Not too many freelancers overseas, but we definitely do use freelancers. And then, of course, our member station reporters, and they are paid by their member stations, and then we pay them for the stories that they do for us on top of that. So that's essentially how the structure works.
And we may only hear from someone like Silvia Poggioli, you know, a couple times a week or, you know, a few times a month, but there's more than that going on in her stories. Some of them might take days or weeks to report.
Exactly. I mean, it can take different beats, involve a different, you can spend, some places are much easier to work than others. Some stories are much easier to tell than others. I mean, a reporter can spend weeks, months working on a story. So, yes, the fact that you don't hear them on air that often doesn't mean that they're not doing an incredible amount of work to bring those stories to air.
We're speaking this hour with NPR's Vice President for News Programming, Chris Turpin, about the inner workings of journalism at NPR. We at Think are spending the week at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Check out our Tumblr that we have recently established. You can see it at kerathink.tumblr.com. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chris Turpin. He is NPR's Vice President for News Programming. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Chris, there is programming that gets turned into time-shifted content later that is preserved. And then there are podcasts that are created by NPR from whole cloth simply for consumption that way. How have programs like Serial and Invisibilia sort of changed the game in terms of the way you think about the definition of what is NPR news?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think one of the things that's becoming clear is there are now so many different models for sort of getting programming, storytelling, whatever you want to call it, to people. And I mean, podcasting is obviously really enjoying its moment in the sun, post-Serial. NPR has always been a huge player in that world. I mean, over the years, arguably we've been the single biggest provider of of podcasts. And obviously, you know, one of the things that podcasting allows you to do is it allows you to reach a different audience. We do know the podcasting audience tends to be younger than the general NPR audience. It allows us to try things out and experiment in ways that are not as expensive as if you're putting a full-fledged program together. And increasingly, you know, podcasting is just one way, a program that reaches an audience. Invisibilia, for example, was a podcast. It was also distributed by member stations across the country. And it went out as segments on the news magazine shows. So increasingly, you know, we're using podcasting is part of a way of almost sort of, you know, carpet bombing the audience and making sure that you can find that program in lots of different places, depending on the way that you listen, the type of listening you like to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Raj in Dallas. Hi, Raj.
Hi, Chris. Enjoyed your show all this time. I have two quick questions. One is to follow up on a previous question. What is the average ratio of time spent by the reporters, you know, for on-air versus background homework? So for every 5 minutes that they report on-air, about how much time do they have to put into a report in the back? And the second question is really a tongue-in-cheek one. You know, how does NPR find all these interesting last names for reporters? I mean, y'all have one of the most assorted and interesting array of names that I hear on the radio. That's it. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
They're actually all called Smith, and when they come here, we just have like a random name generator, and then we find the most interesting name and give it to them. And for the first question, it's a little hard to calculate that, but it's many, many multiples of the time on air is spent doing the background work. I mean, we put stories on the air. Carrie Johnson had some stories recently about to do with sort of prison reform, and those stories took literally months of reporting for what was several stories that were about 5 minutes long on air. So the ratio can be quite extreme. And I don't really know what explains the interesting names. I mean, everyone always comments on this. We do have a lot of people with great names. I don't know what accounts for us attracting such a large proportion of Sylvia Pajolas and Fabio Quistartons.
I suppose it is a factor of diversity, right? The NPR looks for people who come from lots of different places and lots of different backgrounds.
Exactly.
We have an email here from Mary who says, please discuss political coverage. As a voter and as a reporter, I suspect, political coverage feels more like a sporting event than a robust focus on holding politicians' feet to the fire. They are masters at non-answers. What's your philosophy about the right way to do political coverage?
Well, we're actually obviously putting a lot of thought into that at this very moment. One thing we want to do is and we hear this from listeners. You're not the only listener to think like that. When we've done surveys of coverage, one of the things we hear from our listeners is they want less horse race, more substance, if you wanted to distill it. And that's what we hope to do this time around. You have to cover the horse race. And frankly, if we didn't, people would be on our case and telling us we weren't covering, you know, events that they actually are a little interested in, which is where the candidates are and what they're saying and those kind of things. But you can also expect that we're going to be doing some coverage that really goes deep on issues. We're trying to create some beats around things like demographics, around campaign money, that will really look at some of the very important questions that will really sort of determine the next election. And we want to keep very focused on not sort of saturating our programs with election coverage, but making sure that we do stories that help our listeners be informed citizens, informed electors, know what's really going on, and hopefully have a very fair and broad, we've done a really good job of giving them a really good basis for making their decisions come election time. And yes, those interviews, they can be very tough. I mean, politicians are very good at avoiding the questions. And the only thing that you can do is to keep asking them the question, following up on the question and asking them again, all the while doing it hopefully in a way that is sort of civil and respectful. And we hope we can hold people's feet to the fire. Just if I can say one further thing on that is, you know, the other thing we hear a lot from listeners is fact-checking and really making sure that we really sort of look at what candidates are saying and make sure that we hold their feet to the fire for accuracy. And that's something else we want to pay special attention to this time round.
What do you make of the fact that at least on the, I won't even say the political right, but media who are right-leaning characterize NPR as a left-leaning institution?
Well, it's interesting that when surveys have been done of our coverage, that's not what comes out of those surveys at all. I mean, that we're shown as actually having incredibly fair coverage, balanced coverage across the political spectrum. I'll leave others to draw their own conclusions. All I can tell you is that the folks who report here are incredibly fair. They're incredibly thoughtful about the balance that they bring to their coverage. They take that really seriously. We try to scrub ourselves of any kind of biases very hard. And, you know, and I think our political reporting team do an incredible job of that. And, you know, I think people hear sometimes what they want to hear.
One thing that does seem to distinguish NPR is the fact that journalists here stay on stories, or they will continue to return to stories that everyone else has sort of dropped. Talk about how those decisions are made, because it can be expensive, for example, to send somebody back to Haiti to do, you know, an extensive series of reports following up on, you know, the earthquake a few years later, that sort of thing.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I think that strikes many of us as journalists is that sometimes things are in the news for a few weeks and then they're promptly forgotten. And, you know, perhaps traditionally we haven't been that good, or organizations haven't been that good about going back. So we try to make that a part of our coverage of almost any big story, is to make sure that we return to it. We find out what happened to characters who we met, people who we met in the reporting. We'll do the same for Ebola. We did that when we did the China earthquake coverage back in 2008, the Haiti coverage. And I suspect, you know, in a year's time or whatever, we'll be back in Kathmandu to see what's happening there. I mean, we actually have some very interesting stories coming in the not too distant future about the Red Cross and the work that they did in Haiti post the earthquake there. And I think it's very important to do these kind of stories because you want to know how the money's spent. You want to make sure that, you know, if you've given a donation to an organization, you want to make sure that donation is well spent, that money's well used. And that's part of what we do as reporters, is hold folks to account and make sure that promises made are delivered on.
How do you assess successes and failures after a major news event, trying to decide, you know, how to move forward and what to repeat and what to avoid in the future?
Well, we try to get together and have sort of little after action reviews, and we're sort of getting a little more formalized about these things these days. So we just try to ask ourselves, you know, what went well, what didn't go, what could have been done better, and what would we do differently next time? And those are sort of three questions that, you know, can really help frame thinking about how to do these things better next time. And we can always, you know, the good thing is, the beauty of what we do is we do it every day. And the beauty means that even when we don't do it perfectly, we can hopefully do it better the next time around. So we're always looking to try to improve our systems, to improve the way that the speed that we get to stories, and improve our coverage and the way we tell those stories. So, you know, nothing in this business is ever perfect.
Do you have the sense that Americans' attention spans have changed, lessened perhaps?
You know, a lot of people say that, but I actually don't believe that's true. And I think actually the podcasting phenomenon suggests something a little more complicated. I think people want certain types of stories short because they know that information can be conveyed in a very short space. But I think actually people have a big appetite for long form stories that go deep on a subject. If you look at the success of a lot of the big podcasts, that's around. Look at Serial. Who would have thought people would have stayed with a program like that over multiple podcasts like that over multiple episodes, and it would attract such a huge audience. So, I think we're in an odd era where people are both going long and going short. They want information that can be to be conveyed crisply when it can be conveyed crisply, and they want information to be deep, profound, complex, and textured when it can be conveyed in that way. And they can consume information differently at different points of time. In the morning, sometimes you want stuff quickly. When you're doing your shopping on a Saturday afternoon and you've got an hour, sometimes it's nice to put a podcast on and just walk around with the earbuds in and really enjoy something that is much more long form and textured.
What's the relationship between the ombudsman for NPR News and the rest of the staff here?
Good. No, we actually have a new ombudsman, Elizabeth Jensen, who came to us from the New York Times. And I think it's been great. She's doing what an ombudsman should do, which is hold our feet to the fire. I mean, as I said, we're always capable of doing things better. I hope none of us have the hubris to think that we get everything right all the time. And the ombudsman's job is really to represent listener concerns and to really report them out and to hold us accountable and help us learn from the things that we don't do well. And I think Elizabeth's done a terrific job of that. And I think it's a really valuable position for any organization to have.
Is there a specific effort underway to attract people to NPR's many different properties and platforms who historically are not considered to be sort of an automatic part of the audience?
Yes. I mean, we know that we need to diversify our audience. It's something that, frankly, public radio, public media generally is not very good at. So we are looking at ways of, you know, finding ways that will hopefully reach diverse communities, reach them at that point where they're on the same journey that other listeners are towards becoming NPR listeners. So, for example, we know a lot of people come to us through music. Are there ways through music that we can reach out to diverse communities? Are there specific programming topics and choices in the world of podcasts that we can do that will reach diverse communities that we're currently not reaching? So we're spending a lot of thought on this. We know that it's an area that we have to do better. And that's not just a moral question, an ethical question. It's frankly a survival question, because if you look at the demographics of this country, public broadcasting needs to reach a much more diverse audience than it currently does.
What do you see as the greatest strengths of doing journalism without a profit motive?
You know, I think the beauty of it is that no one has ever told me in the time that I've been in public broadcasting for this organization and others, they've never told me why I should or shouldn't report a story because of what a sponsor thinks or what an underwriter thinks or because it's going to be expensive to cover. I think we genuinely are driven by a sense of mission, a public service mission. And I think that it allows us to be able to explore issues that many organizations have frankly stopped exploring, or at least exploring in a serious-minded, thoughtful way. We're committed to topics. Look at our foreign coverage. We have 17 bureaus at a point where virtually every other organization in the country has shrunk their foreign footprint. And they've done that because foreign bureaus are profoundly expensive. If you want to increase your profits, well, that's one way to do it, is not to have foreign bureaus. Meanwhile, we've been able, fortunately, thanks to the generosity of listeners and underwriters, to be able to maintain our bureaus and indeed even expand. So that's a pretty big advantage of being a nonprofit organization.
Given the struggles of so many commercial news organizations, do you think the future may see fewer and fewer for-profit newsrooms and more not-for-profit?
Well, I think what's happening is you're seeing kind of a blended approach. I mean, a lot of organizations are turning to the nonprofit model. Even some for-profit organizations are reaching out now for nonprofit money to support their operations. One of the interesting phenomena has obviously been the growth of nonprofit investigation organizations like ProPublica that has been a profoundly, I think, beneficial presence in the news landscape by doing work that is very expensive, difficult, and goes deep, doing it for basically putting it out there for any organization that wants to cover it and run it. We collaborate with them a lot, and they're great partners. I think the nonprofit model is grabbing. It does seem to be gaining hold. And I think, you know, but also, you know, at the same time, there are very robust for-profit media operations. So I think all in all, we're in a pretty healthy business right now.
Chris Turpin is Vice President of News Programming for NPR. Chris, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me and for being in D.C. this week.
Our think team in Washington includes producer Stephen Becker, executive producer Jeff Whittington, and KERA's Vice President of News, Rick Holter. We also had Elizabeth Ockley engineering from D.C. Back in Dallas, Think is engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Christina Martinez answered phones today. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd in Washington this week. We appreciate it. Have a great day.